Hey,
ta-da!
there
There he
he
is.
is.
Rocking a fold
Ta-da
hole.
is a great way to announce
Are you eating a
yourself.
Triscuit?
No, I'm
You,
eating a pizza.
but you're fronting with Triscuits.
Fronting with Triscuits. Pardon me for eating in front of you.
I've seen you eat in front of me before.
Yeah, well, you
Excuse me.
probably missed it. It's been over a year.
That's
Nom
right.
nom, this is so good.
You're not just impersonating a pilot so you can drink here, are you?
Yeah, that's exactly why I'm here.
You fly boys, you crack me up.
But I keep telling you, I'm not a pilot.
And I keep telling you, you fly boys, crack me up.
This is the Extra Hot Grape Podcast, episode 496 for the week of January 29th, 2024. I am Frostbitten Belly, Gunner David T. Cole, and I'm here with Scenic Route Sarah D. Bunting.
Your heading is zero chunk niner.
Paper bag compromiser, Tara Ariana.
I'm sick!
And meatball in a mask, Jeff Drake.
Please, Major Veal was my father. Call me Tasty Baby Calf.
Welcome to Extra Hot Great. Joining us again, he is a TV writer, most recently of Central Park. You have heard him with us so many times. Please welcome back Jeff Drake!
Jeff
Drake!
Yay. I'm happy to be here.
We're thrilled to have you to talk about Masters of the Air.
Masters of the Air.
Masters of the Air. World War II
no, Jim.
Is about two-thirds over. Not that anyone actually fighting in it is lucky enough to know that. A bunch of pilots ship off to East Anglia to run daytime bombing missions, which in addition to being very dangerous, also seem not to be very effective. Tom Hanks and Steven Spielberg are your executive producers, and they really hope you will like this as much as you liked Band of Brothers and The Pacific, which they also made together. But other than casting something called a Sawyer Spielberg on the show, they are pretty hands-off. Band of Brothers writing staff alumnus John Orloff developed the show. He wrote the pilot as well. The first two episodes are directed by True Detective's sex pest, question mark. Carrie Joji Fukunaga. Only two episodes have dropped on Apple TV Plus. So far, we got the whole season. We will be careful of spoilers if anyone watched ahead. Let us do the Chen check-in. Jeff, should our listeners watch Masters of the Air?
I would say yes, but you're going to need to be a little patient.
Okay, Sarah?
Keeping in mind that frequently my contributions to this podcast are Grandpa Bunsey's History Corner, yes.
Mm-hmm. Dave.
I'm going to go with a no on this one, and I think it's just a fundamental problem with the show for me.
Well, we'll get to it.
And we'll get into it.
Yeah.
All right. I was going to say we're going to get into it. I wasn't going to go on a 3-minute spiel there. I've never done that before. I don't know what you're talking about.
It's a no for me as well. I was bored. But let's discuss. Jeff, I mentioned the two other Hanks Spielberg World War II shows that preceded this one, but Band of Brothers came out in, hold on to your butts, 2001, and The Pacific was in 2010. And both of those times, there was a lot less competition for our TV attention. Do you think we, as a TV watching culture, have evolved past feeling as though a show like this is obligatory viewing?
I think so. It just feels like, especially because it's on Apple TV Plus, which my show was on. And I know, like, halfway into doing the show, we found out like the percentage of eyeballs on that particular streamer at the time was about 4%.
Whoa.
You mean 4% of the TV watching universe?
Of,
is that what you mean?
Of like people watching streamers at the time. Now, certainly more people are watching streamers now than whatever that was 3 years ago. Even when I was working on a show that was for them, I was like, I don't understand what their strategy is.
Yeah.
Like, why not, if you're going to produce shows, then just produce them forever, I guess? Like, start a show and just keep doing it so that you build up. Shockingly, they have, like, the most money of anybody.
Right.
Even more so than Netflix. So they can just do whatever. But I think as far as appointment viewing or whatever, diminishing returns, like, The Pacific was no Band of Brothers.
No, you know? It's true. That's very true. And this goes to Dave's point that we are going to get to still. But Sarah, your complaint, and Jeff just touched on it, about Apple TV Plus shows is usually that their theme is, look how much money we have. It's been a while since I watched The Pacific, but I feel like this looks kind of shittier than that. And The Pacific was made like a decade and a half ago. Did you feel like this was possibly cheaping out, or did it align with your standard complaint about Apple shows?
It aligned with my standard complaint, but in this case, it wasn't a complaint. Like, there were some spots where it did look a little chintzy comparatively, like for an Apple TV product, which, like, the thing with this product is that you are meant to notice how much money has been spent, which is the reason for a pace that is often far too stately for my tastes. Like, here is 10 episodes of this thing that could have taken 7, but we wanted to make sure that you could hear the cash register jingling in every frame. So here's some extra episodes. But there were a couple of sequences, at least in the first 2 episodes, where I was like, it doesn't exactly look expensive, but I see what they were going for, and I get it. Like, some of these bombing sorties are really breathtaking, and just the idea that anyone escaped from this war alive is like, wow, how did anyone manage to survive? I thought that it was effective in that way, and the proportions of being slow and boring to showing off how much money they spent were better than usual. But also, in the first episode, I was distracted. I was unaware that Callum Turner and Barry Keoghan?
I think it's Keoghan, annoyingly, but yes.
Keoghan, whoever he is, my blessings upon this man. Mm. I was unaware that those people were 2 people.
Well, this is a problem.
I thought there was some kind of like mustache dream projection thing. And when it became evident that they actually were 2 separate people and characters, I was like, oh, and I had to like pause it and sort of realign my thinking about the show, which prior to then it seemed kind of annoying. And then I was like, oh, it's 2 characters.
Well, yeah, there's also Josh O'Connor, who plays the like teenage Prince Charles on The Crown. He's another guy who looks exactly like Callum Turner. Mm-hmm. This is a problem with the show. And then in the very first scene, when we find out there's a buck and a bucky, I was like, I don't care if these are based on real guys. One of them has to have a different name. I'm sorry. Like, that on top of how many of these guys look samey, and half the time their faces are half covered by their whatevers, the masks that they have to wear in the plane. This is asking a lot of people who don't have IMDb open in front of them. Jeff, it seems like you were great.
Barry Keoghan or whatever. It wasn't him that I kept mistaking for Callum Turner. It was the other guy with the mustache who then... Until they were in a cockpit side by side, I was like, wait, what's that? What's happened?
Yeah.
What's happened? Uh-huh. Freaky Friday? What?
Yeah.
That's always the problem with like a war thing, because everybody's got short hair. Mm-hmm. And everybody's like young. And I mean,
usually white.
You don't have like the benefit of having pale ginger Damian Lewis as one of them, and then he's paired with darker complected, dark haired Ron Livingston. You're like, I'm not going to mistake those 2 guys for each other.
Yes.
You know, that's very, they did the best job they could, like separating those 2 guys.
Yeah. What they needed was like when you play video games and you're fighting against other people and there's a little triangle over their head with their name. Uh-huh. That's what they needed in Masters. Yeah. In Masters of the Air. Yeah.
Yes. So, Dave, at the end of the first episode, before grudgingly putting on the second, we listed the kind of insurmountable problems with the show. Mine were that we don't get to know anyone before they get in the planes and cover their faces, but also at the same time, having a whole episode about their lives before they shipped out would have also been unbearable. And you said the issue for you was that what they're doing is not a campaign as such. So talk about that.
Right. So I think like the dramatic stakes are different, or at least the dramatic throughput, let's say, are different. Obviously, the stakes are the same. You're probably going to die.
Right.
But in Band of Brothers, there was sort of a more consistent campaign throughput, which is you're going to be in some place and it's not great, and you're going to have to on foot get to this other place that's not great and have fun getting from A to B. Whereas inherently, when you have a show about bombers, whether it's like this or like Memphis Belle, the movie from like 5,000 years ago, it's start and stop. You know, like you fly your plane, you're going to go some bomb some German factory. You get back, maybe, and then you have a fight in the bar. And then 2 days later, you sneak out and fuck the French girl in the countryside or wherever the hell your thing is. And then you come back and you fly another sortie. And it's that sort of rhythm over and over again. And that sort of, for me, that stalls the proceedings every time. And there's something about a war movie where you get back and you have all the creature comforts of homes and then you're all up again. That's very, like, it resets itself so many times that it's hard to have a escalation that pays off dramatically. And certainly in the first couple episodes that are available now, I got that sense where it was just like, I feel like I'm in the same place I was an episode and a half ago.
Yeah.
And for me, that was sort of like the inherent problem with the setting of climbing in a plane every 2 days.
Well, so Jeff said you're going to need to be patient. So, so Jeff, respond to that. What are your thoughts?
It's funny because, like, talking about, like, not getting to know the guys, the very first scene of the first episode, after watching two episodes, I'm still in my head. I'm like, so why that scene?
Yeah.
Why exactly? Mm-hmm. Because later we go through the whole Bucky Buck thing in front of with the English. We could have done that there.
Yeah.
What is it? Just to pull out a picture, rub his thumb across it, gum, stick it to the thing. Like, I'm like, oh, really? Really? After all this time, this is what we're doing? We're still doing that? And it's like, oh my gosh, he has a girl back home? I would rather, like, to me, what made it worth watching was the aerial scenes are grueling. I feel like I need to get out of that plane as soon as fucking possible. Mm-hmm. Like, they do a really good job of, like, even if you don't know what flak is, like, everything's shaking.
Now you do.
And, I mean, you're just like, whatever it is, get me away from it because this is fucking terrible. Mm-hmm. Every scene in a plane was exciting to me. Mm-hmm. I was like, it was handled really well. I thought they spent the money there. And so, like, those scenes to me were worth it. A lot of the other scenes, it's like, I'm not getting, however they did it in Band of Brothers, where I cared about all of those people and I believed that they were in it together. And I think maybe it's some of Dave's point. They do a little bit of that connective tissue with the voiceover, and I think it's Elvis who's doing it.
It's not. It's the pukey navigator.
Really? Okay. Yes. All right. Yeah, that guy's tough to get on board with I mean, not just because of the puking. There's just something, it's kind of overplayed, his thing, I feel like, in the first two. Mm-hmm. But, like, that connective tissue, I feel like, is what you need more of. So that, to address Dave's point, which I think is valid, so that you get a sense of campaign. Mm-hmm. And then there's also, like, the interesting stuff about just some of the particulars of how the missions work.
Yeah, like the processiness I thought was good.
Yeah.
As well.
I mean, I want to know, like, oh, we're talking about, like, a bombing campaign. Like, maybe more about, like, why we're doing this in the daytime. This really does seem stupid. Mm-hmm. You know, as he says at the end of the second episode, it does seem like suicide.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think they do a good job sort of conveying, like, a lot of the money that was spent, like, not to be, like, vibes, but you do get a sense of, like, what that mess tent would smell like, and the sound design is really good. Like, it's very evocative. The money was well spent in terms of looking at it. It is a little disconcerting that Sebastian Kidd from the Carrie Diaries is old enough to fly planes now, but okay. Mm-hmm. Whatever. Like, I still just could not quite adjust that. I'm like, him? He's like 17. He's not. He's like 40. I did think that that was really evocative, and I thought they also did a good job conveying, there's been so much, like, Greatest Generation heroizing, not without reason, but A, this cast a lot of kids who look like kids. Like, mm-hmm. you forget that they were just sending, like, 18-year-olds out on these missions who, like, these kids shave once a month. It's not some brawny Hollywood actor. It's a, he just turned old enough to vote and off he goes. Mm-hmm. And also that the technology, quote unquote, like that very thin veil between you and just falling out of the sky and becoming a grease spot in the Dutch landscape is like that membrane is very thin. And I thought they did a really good job conveying how, like, what a razor's edge they're on in terms of everything continuing to work, engines functioning, what happens if a pebble hits the glass of the cockpit. Like, that's a scrubbed mission, folks. Everybody turn around. So that part was interesting to me. But, like, drunken bike races in the mess hall.
Yeah.
Like, I do agree with Dave that there's, like, a momentum gap here just because of what the show is about. So
yeah,
I think it will depend on your tolerance for that. Mine is, I guess, really high, but then again, I'm an 84-year-old grandpa in my heart.
Yeah. I mean, I sort of felt like there was a tone issue as well, where, like, even when they're on the ground, there's just no, not to say it should be funny, but, like, this is only a few years after we got the Catch-22 miniseries on Hulu that Dave and I watched and really enjoyed. And, you know, it's also about bombers, and the futility is, of course, the point of the story, famously. But also, like, mm-hmm. It makes it so much more watchable when it is funny or has funny moments, even if they're, like, darkly funny, which mostly that is. This just felt so, like, self-important, I guess. I don't know. Especially, yeah. Like, with Elvis still doing his Elvis voice. It's like, you're not getting me there.
I feel like the pitch for this was like, it's World War II in England, a time when the sky was filled with sky hunks. The sky has never been hunkier. I don't get, like, the weight of the death of all of these people that you get from, like, Damian Lewis or Ron Livingston in Band of Brothers, where it's like,
right,
oh, you can sense that, like, they will remember every one of these deaths,
yeah,
and they will carry it with them for the rest of their lives.
Mm-hmm.
Like, there's, with him, he's just a little too handsome, maybe.
I mean, he's from Anaheim, and he looks like he's from Anaheim. Like, no offense to Anaheim, but right. He just does. Like,
and he's either Buck or Bucky or Buckminster. Everybody's got Buck in their name. Yes. I mean, there's also a tiny part of, they kind of, like, visually hint to it, like, but you have to know it, that, like, the Flying Fortress was also, like, I mean, it's a fragile thing in the sky, but also so many of them, like, got blown to shit, but still landed, you know, they would land with no tail. They would land. And so they kind of, in either the first or the second episode where Elvis is walking and seeing the outside of one that's all kind of torn apart. It's like, to me, that's another interesting part of the story that, like, is, like, that's somehow missing, like, the fragility, but also, like, kind of metaphorically, like, you're in this fragile thing that's, like, mostly fabric and, you know, I mean, it's just, you're not protected from anything, but also it will survive somehow.
Mm-hmm.
That was the truth about those planes in a day when planes are, like, things are blowing off of them with regularity. Yeah.
That was also an interesting meta layer. Yeah.
Instead, we get, like, scenes where it's like, why was there a scene with Callum having a person who obviously has, like, Down syndrome or something throwing a dart at an apple on his head, and then he's kissing a girl, and then later, it's just like, what was that even about?
Yeah.
Get me into the air right at the beginning, and then backtrack. Like, instead, it's this whole talk about, like, he doesn't dance, he doesn't drink. I get it. He's Damian Lewis from Band of
Brothers.
Walsh. I get it. Message received. We've got those two guys, only they're recast. Got it.
Yeah.
Got it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I will say this did make me want to revisit Band of Brothers, because it did remind me of how much I liked that at the time. But yeah, I feel like there's a better chance that I will go back and start that from the beginning than that I will continue with this. No offense to Elvis / Sebastian / Austin Butler / the city of Anaheim.
It's okay.
Wait, you didn't find out how it ended.
Yep.
We won.
Hey!
Yay!
All right, it's time to go around the dial. First up, Tara.
Well, get comfy, because my impeccable taste and I are going to update you on Married at First Sight, because the Denver season has been a shit show of record-setting proportions. When I talked about it at the beginning of the season, for the first time ever, a bride had gotten to the altar and then blurted out that she could not do it, and she didn't, and left Michael in the lurch, and we will come back to him. Lauren and Orion seemed real lovey-dovey at the wedding on the honeymoon. However, in the middle of a conversation about prejudice, Orion has been the object of in his life. He is Indigenous. Lauren repeated a slur she was not familiar with. And so the context was, he was like, when people say X, and she was like, X, what? I don't get it. Oh, wait, now I do. Although it's weird she had not heard it before, because it was until recently controversially the name of Washington's football team. She felt very bad. She apologized for basically the rest of the trip. He could not forgive her, even though he also said that when he was younger, he used the N-word until his mother told him not to. And, like, he's 29. Like, he's certainly young enough to where, like, he didn't grow up hearing it. Also, Lauren is Black. Then, when they seemed to be getting on a more even keel, she said she had had sex a few months before she started the Married at First Sight process. He said that was a turnoff to know, so sex for them was off the table. So they split up a few days after getting back from the honeymoon. Claire and Cameron, she is the real short therapist. He's the real tall New Zealand bike repairman. They had a lot of issues. I'll just mention one. They had a party. When the first guest arrived, this guest asked what his parents thought about him doing the show, and he said his dad didn't know, and both women were like, what? And he said, what am I supposed to tell a man on his deathbed? And Claire was like, you never told me your dad was on his deathbed.
Oh my God.
The editors cut in Cameron telling her about his family at the wedding, very much not saying his father was having any health issues. Long story short, they've also split up. Also, as soon as they did, Cameron, who we know routinely spends entire days mountain biking, suddenly developed a heart problem. And I'm not saying he has Munchausen's, because how could I know that? But it is curious, especially since his dad's health problem started immediately after he and Cameron's mother broke up. And that was when Cameron was a teenager. So maybe drama queen syndrome is hereditary. Emily and Brennan, she's the one who had never been in a relationship before. He is the taciturn son of Russian immigrants who stated that he did not intend to fail at marriage. She made an annoying first impression. He seems not to have gotten over, but he is borderline emotionally abusive, so I think as a culture, we are on her side. I now also think she knows that he can't stand her, but also doesn't want to get divorced, so she just purposely is pressing him constantly on their shit to make him give up first, and if so, I respect it, and I hope that she defeats him. Becca and Austin seemed the most lovey-dovey. They still do, but he is super religious and I guess never brought it up at any point in the matching process. And the biggest fight they've had so far is about him being Christian, her having been raised Jewish, but now not really following any religion. And because of this, he thinks this means she is literally going to literal hell and is concerned about getting attached to her because they won't be together in the afterlife. This is an adult person who, like, drives a car and votes. At least one, maybe he doesn't vote, at least one of his religious friends and Pastor Cal, who is one of the show's relationship experts, had to intervene and be like, that is silly, you know that, right? And sometimes it seems like he's trying to unlearn his religious education. It's hard to tell. Their other big issue is he will not put out. Back to Michael, the guy who got left at the altar. Presumably because the rest of the experts' matches have been so bad, they decided to go back to Michael halfway through filming the season to see if he wanted to try it with someone else. He said yes, so they dug in the applicant trash can and pulled out Chloe. And we see footage of them when they rejected her, saying that at 39 she is desperate to get married and that she had several past relationships end because she was too rigid. And while those are the reasons they ruled her out initially, now they foisted her on this poor guy who already had one attempt go bad. The funniest thing is they made all the other couples go to the wedding and give advice on marriage, even though all of their marriages are absolutely hanging by a thread, if not completely over. Terrible season for participants. Incredible season for me, as I said. We're like halfway through. This is insanity. So thank you for your patience. We are all Domer for having listened to me say that. For my plugs, I've been doing a lot of stuff over at Cracked. I reviewed the new Peacock show In the Know, which Dave also had to watch with me, and it was very bad. I also collected the 100 best sitcom punchlines, which was tedious to do, but I think came out well. And as of today, you will probably have seen, or will be able to see, rather, my piece on how Despicable Me 4, which was written by Mike White, that Mike White, all of the ways that trailer is pandering to White Lotus viewers. So all of that is at crack.com, and we will link it in the show notes.
Mr. Jeff Drake, what have you been watching lately?
Well, you know, we don't watch a lot of stuff that's happening. We're watching a little bit of that True Dick, Night Dick.
Sure.
So far, jury's out for me. But the main thing, what we do is at night, we have a 13-year-old who's also our height now. It's very startling. We've been watching Traitors on Peacock, season one. And I have to say that if you have ever played the game Murder or Mafia or Secret Hitler, this show will make you insane to the point of wanting to murder somebody for real. Because every person on the show has absolutely no concept of the gameplay of a game like this. First of all, a lot of people are wrapped up in, she's playing this like it's just a game. Newsflash, everybody. Nobody is really getting murdered. So it is technically a game. But also people will just, they believe people are traitors because they don't like them, but then they don't pay any attention to the fact that, like, they keep voting out people that they call faithfuls, which they could have come up with a different name than faithfuls, but they keep voting out faithfuls and nobody is like, guys, our numbers are dwindling. We need to get this right. Let's think about the numbers. And they literally say things like, I believe this person is a traitor and this person is a traitor. And the proof is, look, the two of them are sitting together over there talking. It's like, you really think the two traitors, if they were the traitors, would go sit off by themselves where people could see them and do their plotting there? You think that's would be their smart way? The people who are the faithfuls on season one are so dumb. And there's a guy named Quentin who, like, at the beginning, we're like, oh, this guy is going to figure it out. He's like a political analyst, and he has been 100% wrong about 100% everything to such a startling degree that literally they're down to, we haven't seen the final episodes. They're down to like seven people, three of which are traitors. Okay. So they're done. The faithfuls are done. There's no way they win. And they just have gone from 8 to 7. Where Quentin has, he has always voted for to vote off the person who turns out to be a faithful. So he's really good. And so, like, they vote off another faithful, and Quentin is like, after they voted off, he's like, huh. As if, like, now maybe, now who should it be? But he's like, he's got no, he literally nobody. It drives Wendy and I, we hate watch it. And our son also kind of hates it too. But, like, Wendy has played so much Secret Hitler and so much murder. She's so good at it. And she's like driven crazy by it because it's just like, you need to confront people and say, like, you're definitely a traitor. Here's why you're a traitor. And like, instead, nobody's doing any of that. Everybody is just like totally clueless. The best part of it is Cerie from Survivor, who's been on like 3 seasons of Survivor. They chose her as a traitor at the beginning. And she is undoubtedly going to win because she is totally dominating the game. Everybody is convinced she's a faithful, and she will eliminate all of the other traitors on her way. And God bless her, because she's the only one who, like, knows how to play the fucking game. And because of the game, my wife has forbidden me from imitating Alan Cumming anymore because it drives her crazy. If I say, oh, are we going to watch Traitors? She does not want me to speak like that ever again in our house. Also, just a side note, 10 new episodes of Bluey finally dropped. And aww. I couldn't love the show more than... And it's not really a TV show, but if you like fun travelogue type stuff, look up Jetlag on YouTube. It's 3 guys who do things like capture the flag in Japan, tag in Europe. The latest one was they went from the northernmost point of the U.S. to the southernmost point as a 2-person teams went on the race. And next season is a hide and seek in Switzerland. And it's very entertaining. There's a guy on it named Ben who is hilarious. it could be a TV show. It's basically handled like that, but it's like, it's on YouTube. It's delightful. Our son introduced us to it, and it's fun for the travel stuff and also for the gameplay and all of that.
Huh. What's the name of it again?
Jetlag. The game.
I'll find it. We'll link it in the show notes. And it's nice to hear about sons introducing their parents to things on YouTube that are positive and not break the brain.
I mean, truly.
What do you have to plug?
Oh, and plugging, I have a very dumb podcast I do with my friend Brooke Dillman. She and I hate the comic strip Nine Chickweed Lane, drawn by Brooke McEldowney. And we thought, what's the worst thing that you could center a podcast around? Of course, a purely visual medium. Mm-hmm. So that's what we do. And yep. We discuss about once a month, we do a new podcast. It's called Nine Chickweed Rage. Mm-hmm. It's very stupid. And if you like stupid things, I think you'll enjoy it.
Love it.
Sarah D. Bunting.
Speaking of stupid things, Homicide: Life on the Street, still not on a streaming service. It really is a crime against heritage television enjoyers. But because our esteemed colleague John Ramos bought me the entire series on DVD, I am able to watch it whenever I need to. And about 10 days ago, I did need to because it was Edgar Allan Poe's birthday. I decided to mark the occasion by rewatching season 4, episode 7 of Homicide. It is called Heartbeat. That episode is available on Daily Motion for now. We will link it in the show notes, knock wood. The basic plot is that in the course of investigating one homicide, a witness to which is named Alexandra Dumas, like, got it, the team ends up finding another homicide victim bad Ronalded into the wall of an abandoned house. This leads them to a street dealer slash poet slash plagiarist played by Kevin Conway, aka Jonas Stern from Good Wife, and... if you're marking a Homicide Law & Order Oz bingo card at home, he played the O'Reilly Patriarch on Oz. He plies his trade outside the same church that hosts Poe's remains and ganks a lot of Poe's verse to pass off as his own, including his lethal homage to the cask of Amontillado. Munch then uses the telltale heart as a fulcrum to get Cordero to confess or to drive him nuts. Same thing, really. I'm not sure that I would necessarily classify this episode as great. There is a lot of stuff in it that I would describe as the annoyance toll that you pay in any given episode of Homicide in order to get access to the good stuff. Like, there's Munch's love life. There's Bayless being self-destructively messy. There's a magical realism collage. But in that way, it is extremely typical of the show. And why those of us who love it do love it, like a frustrating family member with a thing about not remembering to close cabinet doors. It was nice to be reunited with young Andre Brower as well, RIP. And we will link that in the show notes. For my plug, I will also link in the show notes the URL for the new home of Best Evidence. That's my true crime newsletter that I publish with Eve Beatty. And now... with Andy Dennert of Reality Blurred. He's been a guest on this podcast. He reached out to us and offered to give us a new home, and we decided to leave Substack. We are thrilled to be there. It is super fun. And if you are looking for a pre-feud Capote versus the Swans cheat sheet, I just published one a couple days ago, and we'll link it. So come on through. We're happy to have a new spot.
All right, here's what's coming up on Extra, Extra Hot Great this Friday. It is season 2 of The Feud, as Sarah was talking about. That
just
is available.
Feud, Grandma.
Look, I'm sick.
I know.
Survey says.
And you love Steve Harvey, so everything
it's
is The Feud.
The Capote family.
Look, I invite you all to shut up. And then on EHG Prime next week, it is Mr. and Mrs. Smith, and we welcome friend of Jeff Drake's household, Sarah Baker, to come in and talk about that.
She's very delightful.
It is time for the Extra Hot Great Canon. Presenting this week is our guest, Jeff. Jeff, what do you got?
Well, guys... this may surprise you to find out, but I did not bring something from the 60s or 70s, as is normally normally my jam. Instead, I brought you something crazily just from last year, a really great comedy from Australia called Colin from Accounts. There's only 8 episodes of it. It's currently streaming on Paramount+. It's created by the stars who are Harriet Dyer and Patrick Bramall. They play Ashley and Gordon in it. It's a romantic comedy in the vein of Catastrophe and Fleabag. And I feel like the show in general is of that level. Obviously, that's why I'm bringing this in for canon worthiness. The episode I'm bringing is the third episode of the season. It's called Toyota Cressida, or as they say in Australia, Toyota Cressida. The basic setup for the show, so that you understand what's going on here, is that Ashley and Gordon, in the very first episode of the series, she's crossing the street, walking to her job. She's a medical student. He's driving to work. He owns a microbrewery. And sort of capriciously, she flashes a boob at him. He's distracted. He hits a dog. They end up co-parenting the dog, who then, because of being hit by the car, has to have wheels to support his back legs. They name him Colin because he looks like Colin from Accounts. That's the name of the show. Okay, so by episode 3, they're not an item yet, but we know that's going to happen eventually because, as I said, this is a romantic comedy. But Ashley is living at Gordon's house because she's been kicked out of her apartment because of Colin. She's not allowed dogs there. The standards for like a romantic comedy are like you have to be like won over 3 separate times with a romantic comedy. You have to be won over by each of the individual people who are going to be the couple, and then you have to be won over by them as a couple and believe that they could be a couple. And this show passes all of those tests. Exhibit A would be the chemistry between the Ashley and Gordon characters. The two leads are actually married, but as we've seen in other movies and TV shows, that doesn't always mean they have on-screen chemistry. But the two leads absolutely have that here. A perfect example of their chemistry is this opening scene of the episode where they're sitting down to have breakfast. And let's just play that clip.
Look at us, huh?
Yeah.
Like an old married couple. Not since the kids left.
Oh, my God, yeah. Can I say something? I have a confession to make.
Yeah.
I never liked our kids.
Nor did I.
Oh, my God, what a relief.
What are you doing today?
Nothing, just day off. Oh, I've got an appointment, but otherwise nothing.
What kind of appointment?
Just checking my iron or something.
Oh, what's wrong with it? You got anemia?
Nah.
Hemochromatosis.
Look, I know you're a medical student. Please don't use large words over breakfast. It's rude. Okay.
Can I still use your ute?
Yeah.
Yeah, I've got to get some stuff. I mean, Tyler's threatening to sell my shit. I don't know. I should go.
Oh, well, the key's by the door.
This is yummy. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thanks. And thank you for not murdering me while I sleep.
Well, not yet.
Don't make those jokes. I don't know you well enough.
Sorry.
Nah, it's cool. I'll murder you.
Okay. We'll see who gets there first.
Okay.
The thing you miss just listening to this is Ashley's face when she says the final okay. Every nuance both actors add to their performance is just so spot on. They're so, so very funny. The ute she mentions in this is short for utility vehicle, which in Australia means basically pickup truck. Or in this case, it's like a Subaru Brat or an El Camino that she's borrowing. That comes into play later. Exhibit B for this show would be physical comedy. I love watching people fall down, guys. I couldn't love it more. And this next clip, forgive me, is completely physical, but I believe it sounds funny, so I'm including it. What is happening is it's his day off, as Gordon said in the previous clip. He's taking a bath, and Colin is in the bathroom looking adorable. Gordon is like, oh, that's cute, takes a picture, texts it to Ashley with the message, he misses you. He puts his phone down, picks it back up, looks at the picture. Sure enough, you can see his dick. He's just sent Ashley a dick pic with the message, he misses you. So what you're about to hear is Gordon trying to undo the message, dropping his phone in the bath, fishing the phone out of the tub, drying it off, dropping it on the floor of the bathroom, and then flopping out of the bathtub. And let's hear the clip.
No. Oh, fuck.
Now we're into standard sitcom stuff, right? We've seen this before. Somebody has sent a message or left a message, wants to undo it. But what makes this show, this episode in particular, canon-worthy is that even though we've seen things like this before, the way it's handled in this episode is unique and makes it feel fresh in a way that we haven't seen before. Also, Exhibit C, the supporting characters on this show are all just to a T, just terrific. Every one of them scores, even a dying woman with like three lines. She's hilarious. And Tyler, the now former landlord of Ashley, who was mentioned, he's great. He's decided instead of letting Ashley come get her things, he's just selling it all in a yard sale. And so Gordon goes to help Ashley. Mostly he goes to try to come up with excuses to see her phone just for a second. Then Ashley's mom, Linnell, shows up and she is so excited to finally meet the mysterious Gordon. Play the next clip.
Oh, this is Gordon.
Hello.
Linnell. Very normal, Mum.
It's lovely to meet you.
I don't mean to be crass, Gordon, but you appear to be more in my swimming pool than my daughter's.
I'm not much of a swimmer, really.
Happy to teach you. Did Ashley tell you how young I was?
No.
No. Well, she wouldn't, would she?
Oh, no.
I'm so sorry.
No, Peggy's taken a turn.
Oh, what?
Meggle's Nan, she's dying and I've got to go. I've got to go.
Oh, dear God, I'll come. I'm a death doula.
No, she's not. She's not.
Yes, I am. All my friends die.
You keep making friends with people who are dying. That's different.
Death is my constant companion.
Tyler, don't sell any more of my shit. Mum paid for it already.
So, well, that's Helen Thompson as Linnell. And in a world where sitcoms are just filled with nightmarish moms, she really stands out. She's tremendous. We'll hear more from her later. So Ashley talked about Meggles. That's her friend Megan. And Megan's grandmother is passing away, has been in basically hospice care. Gordon goes there to make one last attempt to undo his dick pic. Peggy, her grandmother, is in hospice care very near the end. Megan leaves the room and Gordon and Ashley are left alone with Peggy. Gordon tries again to get her phone, admits to her, like, I sent you something, but like, it's not important. They get in a tug of war, literally over Peggy's body. She's unconscious at this point. The phone that drops out of their hands lands with a thump on Peggy's chest. Play the next clip.
Sorry, Peg.
Don't.
Very sorry.
You're out of control.
Just delete that text. I sent you a text and it was my mistake.
How bad could it be?
It doesn't forget, it's not for you.
Look, man in a bath.
No.
Oh my God. What the fuck?
Don't.
Oh my God.
Don't. Please don't laugh. Don't laugh. Yes, it was an accident.
Oh my goodness, he misses you.
Yes, it was an accident. It was a complete accident. I was just taking a photo of him, but it's a terrible angle and I would never. Don't show it to her. I was just taking a photo of the dog. But look, it's a terrible angle because the water actually acts as a lens which foreshortens the object, which in this case is my dick. Don't.
Yeah.
And if I were to send a proper dick pic, and I have, it would be better. And mine is better than that.
Sorry, what?
Sorry, nothing.
That's Megan re-entering the room at the end of that. So this, for me, is where the show moves up to the next level. We're not even halfway into the episode. And this is normally where, in a regular sitcom, this is where you turn up the heat on Gordon, where like, oh, now we make things worse for it with Ashley's reaction. But instead, the air is let out of the balloon because Ashley, she thinks it's hilarious. And, you know, even so much as to show Peggy, who is unconscious, the pic, like just putting the phone in front of Peggy's face. Later in the show, Gordon returns to Peggy's bedside and she's literally now in her last moments. Palliative care has just been there and given her some morphine. Megan and Ashley are drinking some of her special occasion brandy and Gordon joins them in having a drink to toast her memory. Sit there quietly for a moment and then with a look from Megan, Gordon realizes that Megan has been shown the dick pic and she even mentions foreshortening. But she says it was a nice relief from what's going on and he says, well, you're welcome. At that point, Peggy suddenly gasps and says, it's now, and she dies, but not before saying something racist. Okay, so this scene is Exhibit D, the script writing and tone of this show. It happens so like organically and so naturally. It may not seem like it's a difficult thing to do what's done in this scene, but what happens is, we start off in the tragedy of Peggy's death, which is treated like very respectfully in every way. It's always very respectful. And then immediately into the comedy of Megan has seen the dick pic And then Peggy gasps and she's dying. And so we're back into tragedy. And then she says a racist thing and they have to deal with the fact. Did she just say that? Yes, she did. And so we're back into comedy, but then immediately back into tragedy when Peggy's son arrives too late and he is shattered and he cries. And then he thanks Ashley for being there. And then he puts together that Gordon must be the one who drove the car that he saw out front. Is that a 76 Toyota Cressida? No, 78, actually. Is it, automatic or manual? It's automatic. Oh, six cylinder then. And then ends up saying over his mom's recently dead body, "You're a lucky man," to Gordon, who then thanks him. And then the scene ends with like a very heartfelt, "So sorry" from Ashley and "I love you" to Megan and this whole thing. And it's like with no like button bit of comedy to end the scene. I mean, there's plenty of sitcoms that have been able to swing from tragedy to comedy, but to do it, to swing from tragedy to comedy and then back to tragedy and then back to comedy and then back to tragedy and back, it's insane. And it's so natural. And I literally can't think of another place I've ever seen it done. It's just really like a masterclass in like tone and writing. On their way out, Gordon and Ashley leave, and they immediately run into Linnell. And here's another clip of Linnell.
Goodbye, Gordon.
Bye-bye. Bye.
Bye, Mom.
Bye.
Mom, are you leaving?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you're not going inside?
Mm-mm.
But are you going now?
Yes, I'm going.
Go on.
Yep. Just need to, just to find him.
What are you pretending to look for, Mom? Just go. I want to watch you physically leave. Off you pop.
I just wanted to just go and pay my respects. Just for a...
Yeah? There's actually a dead body in there, Mum.
I know. I'll be really quick.
Mum, just go.
Fine. Don't have children, Gordon. Don't he break your heart.
Okay. Bye, Miss Steinhardt.
Who's Miss Steinhardt?
She is.
Oh, she's going around the back. Mum, I can see you. I've got to follow up.
Two great things about this. First of all, the physical performance by the actress who plays Linnell, looking in her purse and like looking like a wounded bird about not being able to go in and see the dead body. But then at the end, they make the choice in shooting it that it just stays on Ashley and Gordon the whole time that Linnell is obviously like ducking around the side of the house, which is like this bold choice to just stay on them and trust that the comedy will still be there. But like, if you were to show Linnell, it would be hard to do it without it being like too slapstick or too wacky. But instead, you're left to just imagine it. And that kind of confidence in being able to shoot it that way and the performances and all of that is really astounding. Of course, the end of the episode, the two of them end up kissing, Ashley and Gordon do. He had a doctor's appointment where the twist in his general story is he had testicular cancer, and so he's having a cancer checkup to make sure there's no cancer in that area, which of course involves having a camera shoved up his urethra. But his doctor assures him it's very thin, only the width of a pencil. So then tells him, like, you want to avoid intercourse or masturbation, probably don't have an erection because it's going to be very uncomfortable for a little while. Of course, Gordon and Ashley end up having a beer. They end up kissing. They go back to the apartment, start moving towards having sex when then obviously very painful erection happens for Gordon and he calls an end to it, but doesn't tell her why. Instead makes up a couple of terrible excuses, which she does not buy. Then excuses himself to go have a shower. And then we go to this great split screen where we see him on the right-hand side move off to the shower where he can then take the handheld shower head and spray water onto his ailing penis. While on the left-hand side, Ashley, dumbfounded, wanders off, flops down onto her bed, and then says the final line of the show, "What the fuck was that?" And that's the end of the episode. Everything about this episode is like so surprising and so memorable, and rewatching it over and over again has only made it funnier. To me, is like the best example of what you can do in a sitcom with very familiar situations, and fully deserves to be in the canon.
Thank you, Jeff. Sarah, why don't you start us off?
I had never seen the show before, and I think this was an excellent presentation because I am the one on the panel who was like actively turned off by Catastrophe and like comparing something to that. Like, I know that that's meant to be a good thing, but I'm already like, it's already on the back foot. I just fucking hated every single person in that. I know that's the point, blah, 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 blah. So I did have in my notes like, oh, it's Catastrophe Down Under. But I think this is a much sweeter natured show. And Jeff, I think you did a great job pointing up like the number of ways in which it makes things look easy that are actually from a writing and performance standpoint in a sitcom and a rom-com sitcom quite difficult. I will say that the whole like it's only about the width of a pencil and this ancient doctor has golf on and there's misunderstandings. Are you talking about that hole or this hole? I felt like I'd seen that done before, but the rest of it, Jeff's point is definitely taken. The way that it sometimes will faint left and then go right, or just sort of like faint left and then go left, but just at a different angle is good and interesting. I thought the garage sale was edited and written just very quickly, and I laughed a lot at that. The mom is really something, and just like there's things that in her performance that you can't necessarily hear, but she, like when she's offering her hand and she does it sort of in the royal style, like with her knuckles turned up, it's just like, okay, my nan's dying, drink with us, like the order that he gets from the best friend. I don't think I really put this together like consciously, but that scene when Peg is in the throes and about to cross over, it is absolutely true that these deathbed moments are like, it is very, like, it's sad, it's tragic, it's a loss, but there is also like, there are just comedic elements present sometimes. Like, I mean, someone's dad's ringtone may have really not been appropriate, and I'm just going to leave it at that. The dad was mine, bless his heart, and we needed the laugh, but it's really hard to do that in a script. Like, the fact that there are both extremes of emotion and that it's just kind of like messy and ambiguous is not necessarily what you want in your art. Like, you want things to be one thing or the other. You don't want it to be quite so messy. And for a like rom-com sitcom to be able to convey this and not have it feel unfocused and first drafty, but rather organic and documentary is really something. And I think that I did not realize consciously that I was responding to that and to these people who feel very real, like in the way of non-American television, where people like have pores and pass. And it's a little more interesting to watch for that reason. Sometimes American TV is definitely getting better about this, but still, like, it's still a contrast. The line, you buy one unicycle, is just an all-timer. I mean, because she's talking about that, she's like, you just seem single, like really single, not like recently single. And he's like, mm-hmm. You buy one unicycle. Like, I mean, perfect. Chef's kiss.
Yep.
I'm still not totally sure how I'm going to vote on this, but Jeff's presentation really gave me a lot to think about, and not in the like sarcastic way, act out way that we say on certain podcasts, but for real, because from a construction and process standpoint, it was a really cool presentation to listen to. As always, thanks, Jeff. Over to you, Tara.
Yeah, the point that Jeff made up top is that a rom-com has to win you over, you know, three times, and the explication of that I thought was very well done. This particular canon presentation had to win Dave and me over in one extra way, because we tried to watch the pilot of this because it was so widely recommended. And then when the dog getting injured in the first episode is like the catalyzing event, I was like, I don't want to watch this. And we didn't. We turned it off. And so I feel like I now, having come back to it in episode 3, even knowing the dog lives but is, you know, disabled for the rest of its life, I was like, it just seemed like such a sour way to start things off. And I now, having seen this other episode at Jeff's direction, I guess have more of an appreciation that like they gave themselves an extra challenge to write their way out of, like that it is a tough start. Perhaps intentionally, like trying to to give themselves an extra thing to overcome rather than just smooth sailing for this couple, even though we know, as Jeff said, that they're going to get together because we've seen TV before. You know, I can't deny the cuteness of Colin is extremely cute. The amount of mm-hmm. dick in the pic, every time we see it, it's like it's there's so little of it. It truly is just the tip. It's like so innocuous. It looks like you could be a thumb. Like you, it's so funny every time they show it. And I agree too with Jeff that like the best scene is the death scene because of how it mixes the comedy and tragedy. And poor Bernie getting distracted with his compliments for the car. Like it just all of, and then being overcome and just sobbing in the middle of his compliment. That all felt extremely true, including that Megan would say, thank you for sending this by mistake. It was a nice distraction because when you're in those moments, you are looking to feel anything else, even for a second. And there are absurd things that happen when you're in those moments. The unicycle line was another one I also cited. The doctor calling his penis a handsome fellow. Like, of all the things to hear from a doctor, like, I don't know, dude. Keep that to yourself, even if it's true. Linnell, definitely a standout with the narcissism, saying she's a death doula because all her friends die, and then saying she's there because she and Bernie play Farmville. Like,
I know.
All of the details of her character were so great. And, I mean, for Jeff to include the phrase, his ailing penis, as part of his presentation, I mean, I think that's something we've never heard on this podcast or possibly on Earth before. So,
yeah, it's about goddamn time when you think about it. It
deserves note for that alone. So, yeah, I wouldn't say I went into this with like arms crossed, like impress me necessarily. I trust you. I know you have good taste. I was hopeful that it would be good and entertaining and like, it was. This is strong stuff. And considering where it started with me overall, not necessarily just with this episode, that's not nothing. Dave.
I think the only other thing nobody's talked about that I felt was a little too real maybe was Gordon's reaction to having the only pencil thin tube stuck up his his ping pong, which is which is very much like the Mr. Show skit where they're thinking about whether to give change for a dollar so he can put it in the music. Which is exactly what I would do in that situation. I didn't like that general part of the episode, not because of like, you know, because it made me feel oogie, but like that doctor bit with like, oh, the doctor just wants to watch golf was like the most sitcom-y of this. Yeah. It was like the weakest link in a show that seems to generally operate above that sort of thing. But the rest of the episode, for all the reasons that Jeff and everybody said, really strong entry. And a reaction to seeing a dog die or hurt is a very personal thing. So don't bag on Tara too much for that. It was at a time in our lives when we probably didn't need to see that as well. So very strong. A lot of good Australian comedies coming out and New Zealand comedies coming out recently. I think if you like this, also, it's not a comedy in the same way, but it reminded me of Frayed a lot.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Making things seem real in a universe that is not real. Like, there is something very true about everything that happened in the death scenes, and I don't really think it would play out that way in real life necessarily, but it had the feel of being very real. And so I think it operates within that universe's sitcom, rom-com rules and making it feel immediately translatable to something that would happen to us. I thought that was a great touch for the show. Thank you, Jeff, for bringing it back to our attention. I think we'll probably pick this up. But for now, let's put this to the vote. Sarah D. Bunting, undecided moments ago, but now you must vote.
Yeah, and I must vote first, which I don't care for. I didn't necessarily want to watch more of this. There was the weak part with the old doctor and the handsome fella. Maybe I'm voting more for the presentation than for the episode itself, but sometimes that's how it goes. So I will vote yes. Fuck it.
Tara.
I will vote yes as well.
Me too.
Yay.
All right, that means Colin from Accounts, Season 1, Episode 3, Toyota Cressida, you are hereby inducted into the Extra Hot Great Canon.
Americans love a winner.
Yup.
And will not tolerate a loser.
Nope.
Mmm. Mm-hmm. It is time to discover the winner and loser of the week. Tara has this week's winner.
Sort of. This week's winner is Kate Hudson, who is going to be headlining a basketball comedy series from Mindy Kaling, in which she plays a woman who comes from a family of competitive brothers, and she takes over the family's basketball team after one of them has a scandal. And so already it's like sort of based on the Jeannie Buss story. As far as I know it from Winning Time, I don't know anything about real life and I don't care. But this is like the version where it's like she doesn't know a sports, as far as I can tell from the description so far. So in addition to not being Winning Time, I hate it. So winner is Kate Hudson, loser is me, and Winning Time forever. Boo.
And Sarah, who is this week's loser of the week?
Only on Bravo. Carolyn Manzo is suing over producers turning a sexual assault into, quote, entertainment and encouraging Brandy Glanville's, quote, sexually aggressive behavior. I actually had to check this to make sure that this wasn't something that we had already reported like 2 years ago. I just feel like various lawsuits / accusations about this topic have been blooming like an onion for a while, but no, this is a new headline and it's gross and is giving me flashbacks to like The Challenge and Tanya being like, does someone want to do something about these guys? And MTV being like, nah, figure it out, Bravo.
Before I say, speaking about figuring it out, I do want to say I am so sick. I think I just asked Sarah, who is this week's winner of this week earlier? So good on me. You know what time it is? The good news is new episode. The bad news is blah, 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 blah. All right, this is the first game time of the season, I believe. Yes?
Yes.
Yes, hooray! Woo. The season scores, therefore, are 0 for everybody. Today, we are playing Third Word Problems from Mr. Dan Cassino.
Damn you, Cassino!
Who earns himself an extra credit topic of his choosing, plus, if he wishes, a free shirt or something from ThroughMethods.com store. Dan writes, sadly, most modern TV shows don't have intro songs with memorable lyrics or, even better, voiceover narrations explaining the premise of the show. But how memorable are these intro lines or lyrics anyways? Are they memorable enough that you could pick them out of, say, only every third word?
Oh, no.
Oh, God.
In this game, I'll give you the third, sixth, and ninth words of one version of the theme song lyrics or intro voiceover of a TV show. You name the show based on that alone, you get 3 points. If you can't, you're going to get guessed at every level. I'll stitch another 3 words into the mix, after which the answer is worth 2 points. If you still can't get it, I'm going to give you all 9 first words of that theme or voiceover, after which the answer is worth 1. So 3, 2, 1, guess after every hint.
Okay.
All right, here's an example for you. Shout it out if you know it. Again, I'm giving you the third, sixth, and ninth words of the lyric or voiceover intro. Criminal the Represented.
Law and Order.
Law and Order is the correct answer there. If you didn't know, I'd be giving you more words and more words until you did. All right, Tara, steel mill situation, please.
Thank you, Dave. Sarah has 4. I have 3. Value guests have 3, plus Eric's meal for a total of 4.
All right, so you can only steel mill at the 1 point level because of the way the game goes, but that 1 point may make the difference. So. Sure. Jeff Drake, to remind you, the Eric's meal, that one extra one, always turns over. So there's no reason not to try to steal at least once in this game.
Great point.
Cost you nothing.
It. I'm just very excited that knowing that there's no voiceover at the beginning of the shows that I always get questions about, which is Beverly Hills 90210 and Melrose Place, which I need to remind everybody, I have never seen a minute of either of those.
So. Oh, congratulations.
Stay strong.
All right, let's go to the picky. See who's going first.
We will start with Sarah.
All right, we're going to go Sarah, Jeff, Tara, order today. 30 questions, 1 gross worth equalizer challenge zone, right in the middle of everything. Are we ready to play Third Word Problems?
Yes.
Yes.
Sort of.
Sarah D. Bunting, time used friends.
Friends?
Long time we used be friends.
Oh, Veronica Mars.
Veronica Mars, that's good for 2 points. A long time ago, we used to be friends. Jeff Drake.
Yes.
Banner, searching, way.
The Incredible Hulk.
The Incredible Hulk. Dr. David Banner, physician scientist, searching for a way. Blah, blah, blah. Tara.
Yep.
Astronaut, barely can.
$6 Million Man?
Steve Austin, astronaut, a nice. Man barely alive, we can, etc., etc. Sarah D. Bunting. Is of course.
Star Trek original series?
Horse is, horse of course.
Oh, Mr. Ed.
Mr. Ed, a horse is a horse, of course, of course. All right, Jeff, probably the most difficult one in this game. Men, men, men.
I would say 2.5 men.
You are correct. Wow. 8 men's and 1 manly in that full description.
I'm sorry that we didn't get to hear men, 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 followed by men, men, men.
I was tempted.
Men, men, men,
I was
men.
Very tempted.
It would be men, men, manly, men, men, men.
Oh, of course.
Yes. Tara. Excuse me.
They're so mad. Yes.
A go, commando sent.
A-Team?
A-Team is correct. Nicely done. That is the nice. Later season one where they switched from 1972 to 10 years ago. A crack commando unit was sent.
Mm-hmm. I mean, when they're talking about commandos, I was pretty sure it wasn't Murder, She Wrote, for example.
All right, Sarah, you ready?
Sure.
Flight Dangerous Ah. Flight Dangerous Ah.
Flight Dangerous Ah. Twilight Zone.
Shadowy Flight, The Dangerous of Ah. Shadowy Flight, The Dangerous of Ah.
Knight Rider?
Knight Rider, a shadowy Eight flight words. Into the dangerous world of Ah.
Nice.
Nicely done. Man Back to Mr. Jeff it. Drake.
Yes.
Way Played Made. Way Played Made. Way Played Made.
Queer Eye for the Straight Guy. I'm going right. to need number two here.
The Way Miller Played That Made.
Oh, All in the Family.
Boy, the Way Glenn Miller Played Songs That Made, blah, blah, blah. Correct.
Sure, sure.
Tara.
Yep.
Listen, Story Man.
The Beverly Hillbillies.
Beverly Hillbillies is correct. Come and listen to a story about a man. Sarah D. Bunting. Story lovely was.
This is what I'm waiting for.
Brady Bunch.
Brady Bunch. Here's the story of a lovely lady who was. Jeff Drake.
Yes.
Wanna our be.
Wanna, like W-A-N-N-A?
That's correct, yeah. Official lyric search confirms is wanna, not want to. I had to correct this question from Dan Casino, in fact. As a professor, he thought it was want to. Mr. Dan Casino, please. All right, once again, wanna, our, be.
I gotta go to the second clue.
Don't wanna, for our, to be. Don't wanna, for our, to be.
Oh, God, is it Family Ties?
There's the Shit. Full 9 words.
Damn it.
I don't wanna wait for our lives to be.
God,
I don't wanna wait for our lives to be.
I don't wanna wait. Yeah, I can sing it. I can't pull it.
Someone doesn't Steel listen meal. To our Steel sister meal. Podcast and it shows.
Sarah D. Bunting Steel Meal.
Dawson's Creek.
Dawson's Creek is good. 1 point steal.
Sure.
Tara.
Yep.
Out, Road, and.
Next, please.
You're out, the road, lonely, and.
Next.
If you're out on the road, feeling lonely, and.
Gilmore Girls
is correct. Sarah D. Bunting. Jungle Disorder Everywhere. Jungle Disorder Everywhere.
George of the Jungle.
A jungle, their disorder, confusion everywhere.
Oh, shit.
Lost?
Famous Lost song.
Yeah.
It's a jungle out there, disorder and confusion everywhere.
Monk.
Monk is correct, yes.
Oh, wow.
Fuck.
Whew, Jeff.
To move yes. out if I didn't get that one.
Just before we go, I just have to say Dawson's Creek is the Melrose Place of yeah. Dawson's Creek.
As soon as I saw it, well, that's delicious. Yeah. Thank you very much for bringing that up before the game began, because now you got the third show.
Of course I did. Of course I did.
Again with this. Oeuvre. All right.
Picky hates me.
No, Picky loves you in that way. Right, Yol, Tail. Right, Yol, Tail.
Gilligan's Island.
Gilligan's Island is, in fact, the right answer. Just sit right back and you hear a tale. All right, Tara, good luck.
Okay.
The Lived Harmony.
Next.
Ago the nations lived in harmony.
Next.
Long ago, the four nations lived together in harmony. You have heard this maybe once in your life.
The four nations. I don't know. It's not Battlestar Galactica, because I've definitely heard it more than that. I don't know.
That is Avatar, The Last Airbender.
Oh.
Airbender. Yeah. All right, that is halfway through our game. Let's hear them scores.
Okay, Sarah and Jeff are tied with 11 points each, and I have 10.
All right, that means Tara. Guess what?
Come on!
All right, Tara, lots of choices here. Which box do you want to use?
Whichever one has 90s questions.
That would be the 90s pop culture edition.
90s pop culture edition, please.
We are going to go through the viewing categories until we get you 6 TV questions. The bonus for this set is that you also get the year of the subject matter.
Okay.
How many points are on the table for T-Bone?
Burp. Let's say 2 and 4. Viewing 1993, Tara.
Yep.
What actor's wife played Norm's wife, Vera, the few times her voice was heard on Cheers?
George Wentz.
George Wentz is correct. 1997. What incomprehensible blaxploitation hero was spawned by The Chris Rock Show?
Hootie Tang.
Hootie Tang is good. 2 for 2. 1996. What MTV comic was the only guest host in the 4-year run of The Late Late Show with Tom Snyder?
Ooh, Jon Stewart.
Jon Stewart is correct. There is your 2 points.
Woo.
Get the next 3, we'll double that.
Okay.
Who rode in 1996 his Taster Choice fame to a leading role on Buffy the Vampire Slayer?
Anthony Stewart Head.
Yeah.
1995. Who went on to star in films like Pulp Fiction and Die Hard 3 after a 3-year stint as Bill Cosby's stand-in on The Cosby Show?
Samuel L. Jackson?
Yep.
Wow. I didn't know that.
All right. I think you might be able to sweep it with this 1995 question. What did Seinfeld's Frank Costanza want to call the bra for men that his co-inventor Kramer dubbed the bro?
Oh, thank you, because I couldn't remember which of them wanted to call it what. The man's ear.
The man's ear is good, and that's 4 extra
well
points.
Done.
So let's get that updated scores, please.
Okay. Sarah and Jeff are tied with 11 apiece. I have 14.
All right. Doesn't feel right when you get to use Grocer's Legalized Child Zone, but then the rules. That's just the way it goes.
Yeah.
All right. Still got another half of this game to go. To remind you, I'm going to give you the 3rd, 6th, and 9th word of the opening lyrics or voiceover to a TV theme. Sarah D. Bunting. And aboard you.
The Love Boat.
The Love Boat.
Holy
love,
shit.
Love, exciting, and new. Come aboard. We're well expecting done. You. This is question 17.
Oh, that's pretty cool.
It's pretty cool.
For Jeff. Way, world, everything. Way, world, everything.
Next.
Your way, the world, takes everything.
Oh, the Friends. Jesus.
Incorrect?
No!
Making your way in the world today takes everything.
Oh, Cheers.
Cheers, yes.
It's confusing because they were friends.
Yeah.
And friends did sometimes drink.
They did.
Mm-hmm.
Tara.
Yeah.
Is All My.
Next.
This is Story All How My.
Fresh Prince of Bel-Air.
Now, this is a story all about how my. Yes. This is Question. 19. Now, this is the most difficult one.
Oh, shit.
Even more difficult than the 2.5 men question. Roland.
Rawhide.
Yes. That was 9 Rolands for those keeping track at home. Not even a Roland Lee in there. Jeff. Rawhide.
Yes.
13th was remove. 13th was remove.
Next.
November 13th, Unger was to remove.
Oh, the Odd Couple.
On November 13th, Felix Unger was asked to remove. Yes. Tara.
Yes.
Final R of.
Next.
The final, these are voyages of.
Star Trek The Next Generation?
I'll give it to you for Star Trek. It's just Star Trek.
Oh, okay.
Space, The Final Frontier. These are the voyages of... I don't want letters from you Star Trek people. Sarah D. Bunting.
Famously, they love writing letters?
It was slightly different in Next Generation.
Okay.
Sarah D. Bunting, one travel own. One travel own.
Next.
That one, time travel, his own. Jeff Drake nodding knowing the things, playing psychological
Journeyman.
Warfare.
Journeyman, I don't know. Next.
Theorizing that one could time travel within his own.
I don't know. Quantum Leap?
Quantum Leap is correct.
Oh, great.
1 point.
Yay.
Oh, great.
Jeff Drake.
Yes.
About another dimension.
Twilight Zone.
You are about to enter another dimension. A dimension, et cetera, et cetera. Tara.
Yes.
Here's your tough one. Mm. The Gary's theme.
It's Gary Shandling's show.
This is the theme to Gary's show. The theme, etc., etc. Yes. Sarah D. Bunting. On Driving Sun. On Driving Sun. Sun as in the big ball of hot gas up in the sky.
Right.
Giving you warmth. Lighten your days. Having it all. On Driving Sun.
Are you okay?
No, I'm really sick. I'm tired. And I got to the point now where I'm just sort of goofy.
Okay, great.
I
don't know. So hint, please.
Been on Run Driving the Sun.
Oh, I'm going to be mad, but I need the last hint.
We've been on the run driving in the sun.
Masters of the air.
Driving in the sun.
I don't know.
That's what incorrect. That is the OC.
Fuck.
All right. Back to Jeff Drake.
Yes.
Moving to side.
Next.
We're moving up to east side.
The Jeffersons.
Jeffersons, good for 2. Tara.
Yep.
You who are.
Next.
Are you who are?
CSI.
Who are you? Who? Who are you?
Are you who
are? All right. There it is.
Yeah.
The take you. The take you.
Next.
Take the, you take, bad you.
The facts of life.
Take the good, you take the bad, you, etc., etc. Jeff Drake.
Yeah.
Up, got, gun. Up, got, gun.
Next.
Woke up, morning got a gun.
Oh, Soprano.
You woke up this morning, got yourself a gun.
There's yes. a U in there?
Huh. You woke up this morning, you got, yeah. Okay. Last question of the game is for Tara.
Okay.
And mysterious there.
Next.
Creepy and kooky mysterious spooky there.
The Addams Family.
The Addams Family is correct, and that is regulation. Nice. Let's hear the scores.
Okay, this was a really close game. Sarah finished with 20. Jeff had 21. I had 25.
And that's
thank
the
you, Equalizer
wow.
Challenge.
The Equalizer.
Equalizer Challenge Zone and knowing a whole bunch about 90s TV. All right, we have one steel mill here. I'm going to use it for a future steel mill. Here we go. Shout it out as soon as you think you know it. Knock door waiting. Knock door.
Freeze Company.
Waiting. Come and knock oh, nice. On our door. We've been waiting. Yes. Three's Company. Tara gets one company. Extra steel mill and wins the day.
Tara.
Tara. Tara. Thank you, Dan.
Thank you, Dan.
That is it for another episode of Extra Hot Great. We checked out the pilot episodes, delicious, of Masters of the Air before going around the dial with stops at Married at First Sight, The Traitors, Bluey, and Homicide. Jeff's canon presentation for Collins from Accounts added up. We crowned winners and losers of the week, and Tara was the winner of this season's first game time from Mr. Casino. Next up this Friday, it's The Family Feud Season 2. With, no, that's no.
No.
No, no jokes. No, nobody got the call back. Nobody wanted to hear the call back there. Next up is Feud Season 2 this Friday on Extra Extra Hot Great. And come back here next week. It's Mr. and Mrs. Smith with Sarah Baker. Remember.
We're listening.
I am David T. Cole. And on behalf of Tara Ariana.
If anyone wants me to talk about Married at First Sight for 3 or 4 more hours, I can.
And, okay, Sarah D. Bunting?
I would murder a beer.
And Jeff Drake?
I'm so sorry about bringing something to the podcast about an injured dog.
Thanks for listening. We forgive you, and we'll see you next time right here on Extra Hot Great.
It was actually a nice distraction.
Well, glad to have helped.